The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
This is the key.
Welcome everyone to Tando Radio Show, by Black Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, David Rand, a.k.a. Dave from L.A. Today is a October the 6th, 2015. And today we have a live show for you. And as always, everyone, please continue to support Black Talk Radio Network. It's so needed so that we can continue to have the outlets that we do have, and it's so important that we do, because, you know, we already know what's going on in the world, and we need to really understand what's happening, and we need the support of Black Talk Radio Network and all of the programming that's brought to you. So hey, tell your friends, tell your family, and also make financial donations if you can, because it's so needed at these times. We really need to continue to operate in a place where we know the information that we're giving is in our best interest. And right now, it's an age of information. So much is happening, and we need to know what's going on in the world. So, hey, please support Black Talk Radio Network and everything that's being done there. Also, go to Tando Facebook page and check us out there. See what we're posting. And if you see something you like, give us a like there. It's so, you know, it's a real nice gesture for us all to see what's happening, and it gives us an idea of where it is that you are and what it is that you're looking for. So, but just wanted to say, hey, today's show, wanted to hurry up and jump into it, is, you know, with everything that's happening, but before we jump into today's show, I want to just bring you up to date on some things that's very, very important that has happened, you know, since yesterday, you know, today's news. Well, there's an article. Oh, my man, this is crazy. Ben Bernanke calls for a prosecution of top financial executives over the 2008 meltdown. See, this dude was engineered and was a part of the whole thing. And it's crazy. But this tells you that the financial system is nothing. It's completely fraudulent. And you need to get out of that system completely and to hedge yourself in a proper way, because, you know, they're nothing more than market riggers. They're able to rig the overall market. If you don't know how to leverage that to your advantage, you're only going to lose. And it's so important that you know that these markets are rigged, and they plan on totally annihilating everything that you have, because that's how they're able to have their quality of life and their standard of living. It's from the fraudulent manipulation of being a market maker. You can't bet against those that are making the market. It's impossible. And they continue this, and they give you all the clues in the world. They tell you, well, this dude says that they should, but he should definitely, because he was involved in it for years, the overall theft of people. You know what, the market is nothing. Bernie Madoff has done nothing compared with what the market has done and what it continues to do. And I hate to say it, but your jobs, your corporate jobs, your 401k, they're all complicit in all of this, because they're gaining from the fleecing of you also. So listen, people, it's time for you to take action and be your own advisor, and to learn the system so that you can properly hedge yourself, you know. We teach a precious metals class. That's something you definitely should partake in, because, you know, with me, and I don't care what they do with the price of silver and gold and how they manipulate it. I win either way it goes. So you need to actually be taught and understand that and see how it works. And once you do, it'll make all the sense in the world. It's being manipulated by the market to totally take everything from you. And this is what this dude is basically saying. And he should be one of the ones that should be incarcerated also Ridden along with it. I have a much more severe penalty for them all because they continue to steal. Let me tell you, the ones in the suit is much deadlier than the ones with a gun because the suits are generational killers. Now, the next very important article, the renminbi, the yuan, overtakes the yen as the world's fourth most used payment currency. The rest of the world is running into the renminbi, and that's telling you that they're running away from the Western financial system, the dollar, and everything that goes along with it. Pretty soon, the renminbi will be number one. And when that happens, and if you haven't hedged and you haven't prepared yourself for it and you haven't taken the appropriate steps to protect yourself and your family for it, you think you know poverty now, you know nothing. Wait until the rest of the world continues to run away from run into the renminbi. And that how they're going to do it is that I believe that China is going to back their currency with gold and silver and other items that the U.S. government, you and the U.S. public doesn't have, because they have to. And there's an article that we're going to get into tomorrow that's so, so important. I need one whole show just for that, to explain that to you and how and what the real relevance and importance of that is. Next, you know, I had talked about last week we were talking about the overall radiation poisoning, and I talked about how in Chernobyl, which is in the Ukraine, how the actual Chernobyl event, the animals in that area are thriving, and they actually have turned the radiation into minerals for their bodies. It's amazing the adaptability that life has. And so today, lo and behold, there was a report out of the Iris Examiner talking about just that. It says the wildlife in thriving in Chernobyl, and that's because with the radiation, their body has converted it into a mineral. Powerful, powerful. Just to let you know the overall relevance of what God has created, and the persistence and the relentless quality that we have to live on and to survive through all different harsh environments. The wildlife is thriving there in spite of the untapped radiation that's coming out from Chernobyl. Also, another one, China is now joining in the airstrikes with Russia. I'm telling you, this thing in Syria is going to continue to, I think, is going to continue to expand. If you look at what's happening, pretty soon I think that Russia will establish a no-fly zone. Once they put their S-300s in place, they're basically saying it's a totally no-fly zone, and that is going to bring about a crisis. And then not only that, there's reports that not only is Russia ready to send in troops, but also Iran, they're going to support and kick out the Free Syrian Army that was completely funded by the U.S. as well as with ISIS and everything else. They're going to kick them out, and I'm going to tell you, that is going to be a problem that could really turn into a whole lot more. I really believe that we're one incident away, and there was another incident where one incident away from an all-out confrontation between NATO nations, Russia, China, and all of its allies. Turkey has said that if Russia continues to fly into Turkey, their planes will be subject to shoot down. Well, when that happens, stand by. And if that happens, stand by. And also, I believe that the confrontations between the U.S. and Russia aircraft in those skies are getting closer every day. They've been within 20 nautical miles of each other, which is nothing. That's in dogfighting range. There is going to be an incident that could springboard this into an all-out World War III scenario. And it's everyone is running there with their assets, their military assets, advisors, and their troops. So it is a place where the line in the sand has been drawn. So continue to watch that, and I'm really watching it and cautious about it, and even more little concerned about it, because I knew that, not sure what how they wanted to do things, but it is definitely going to be done. But hey, listen, today's show is that I wanted to play something for you guys. It's a relatively long video, but it's so important because these people tell you everything before they do it. And it's something called Washington, D.C. Gets Nuked. And to hear this video and listen to the FEMA preparation, the continuity of government that has already been established, and I'm telling you, there's a lot that's being said, and there's a lot that you can learn from this. How you have to be proactive in your preparedness, especially if you live in areas of large population, because, you know, I wanted to play this because now this is really on the table in so many ways. It's on the table from the overall influx of refugees that will be accepted here in the United States, and this is something that's plausible because of the geopolitical situation, the deterioration of the countries and the overall precedent of the past. When these types of situations start to happen, the advent for military confrontation is great. And I do, you know, it is not something out of the realm of possibility that this can turn out into an all-out shooting war between the U.S. in exchange of nuclear exchange also. There is no MAD, there is no deterrent, mutual assurance deterrent. There is none, other than that they mutually are going to do it. And I believe that this is something that will be on the table. Guess what? It's nothing new to this planet. It's nothing new in the past. There have been nuclear wars that have been fought that they don't tell you about in history that have already been fought in the past. Yes, nuclear confrontations, all-out nuclear wars. The evidence is there. You can't even refute it. You can't argue against it. If you know anything about science, you know anything about nuclear confrontations or what nuclear war or nuclear detonations, what the scars and the evidence of that is, it's undeniable. The evidence is there where total areas have been glassed over, and the only thing that can do that is a nuclear exchange. And the radiation, the background radiation from those areas are extremely high. And so just the evidence, and this is not just in one place, this is in a couple of places on this planet where there have been ancient nuclear wars that have been fought. What they tell you now about the past is such a deceitful lie. The technology of now is not advanced. It's actually subordinate to the technology of the ages before, way before. And they keep these sciences and they keep this information hidden from you, the general public, so that you can be easily manipulated. But hey, check this out. We want to go to this video. It's a good, relatively long one, but what I really want you to listen to is how to prepare, what to think about. This is just something that will give you ideas as to what you may contend with where you are. And even if you're not near a heavily populated area, you will have adverse things to deal with because of a major nuclear attack anywhere in this country. If that happens anywhere in this country, or pretty much an all-out nuclear device goes off anywhere in the world, within 48 hours, the U.S. will be under complete martial law. Completely. Complete martial law. And there are things that you need to know how to respond to that accordingly. And I'm telling you, I really do could see that a nuclear exchange to happen in the Middle East and then spread to other countries, adjacent countries, or somewhere in the Ukraine, somewhere in the South Sea of China. All of these places are extremely vulnerable to the prevalence or the opportunity or the situation for a nuclear exchange. And if that happens, you will be under martial law within 48 hours. And you need to respond to this appropriately and very timely. There's no time for watching the news, seeing what's going on, and grabbing some popcorn and watching. You need to act immediately because time is running against you. It's so important. So let's check this video out and learn as much as you can, and we'll come back and talk about it.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
A nightmare becomes reality.
Nuclear weapon has been exploded in this area.
A loose nuke, a capital destroyed, a nation in shock.
If you're at the epicenter of this blast, unfortunately, you're not going to make it. You will most likely be vaporized.
Today, the threat of a nuclear attack is greater than ever.
There's no dispute, whatever. This is where Al-Qaeda wants to go.
A look inside the government's plan to save America.
The worst case scenario really is that a nuclear weapon could wipe out the entire leadership of the U.S. government.
The threat is real. The clock is ticking. Is America ready for the day after disaster?
Ask you, if you were a terrorist and you were looking at where would you strike, what would be your number one target? If you were an international terrorist and you were against the Western ideals, where would you choose?
Washington, D.C. is the number one target. It's the symbol of everything that we stand for, the foundation that the country was built on.
The single greatest danger to the U.S. today is the danger that terrorists successfully explode a nuclear bomb devastating the heart of one of our great cities, a nuclear 9/11.
If you're at the so-called epicenter of this blast, unfortunately, you're not going to make it. You will most likely be vaporized. I mean, you're going to be at the center of what you might consider to be an exploding sun, in essence. The amount of energy from radiation, from blast, from heat is going to be such that we will see absolutely no survival at this epicenter.
5,000 people die instantly. More than double the casualties of 9/11, incinerated in a fraction of a second.
Think about that bomb exploding in the city where you live, and think about the consequences. Everything a third of a mile from ground zero would disappear instantaneously, vaporized in this huge release of energy that reaches about 540,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
The detonation is followed by an intense flash of light, the hallmark of a nuclear explosion. Another 10,000 people will die in a matter of seconds, 15,000 more injured. Anyone 0.6 miles to 1 mile from ground zero survives the initial thermal pulse, but not for long. The speed of light, the flash, travels faster than the blast overpressure. The next victims see the light, followed by a deafening boom, just seconds before the structure they're in collapses.
there would be blast victims, there would be burn victims, there would be people, just like with the tornado, who are embedded with or impaled with objects.
15 seconds post-blast, 30,000 dead or injured. Ground Zero, the Capitol Building, the Supreme Court, Library of Congress, National Air and Space Museum, all within a half mile, gone. The White House sits 1.39 miles from Ground Zero. Made of reinforced concrete and shielded by the Treasury, damage is heavy, but less severe.
There is the immediate problem of trying to find who's alive and capable of acting at the moment, and that's especially the case in the case of a president.
It would not be immediately obvious where all of the people in the national chain of command, from the president to the vice president, and the whole succession of cabinet officers who would assume responsibility if those above them do not survive.
Further outside Ground Zero and the blast zone, chaos is unleashed. Streets and highways are clogged with blinded drivers. Many stared directly at the thermal flash. ...2,400 experience temporary flash blindness. Another 1,000 are permanently blinded, their retinas seared. The 10-kiloton blast emits a deadly electromagnetic pulse that spans 3 miles. Planes crash. Cars die. Cell phone towers go dead. This is not a scene from a Hollywood movie. This is one of the top threat scenarios facing the U.S. government today.
Many things that we think couldn't happen have happened. We see this over and over in history. If we don't prepare for them, we're not going to be able to manage them.
If and when a nuclear bomb explodes and destroys an American city, if there's a commission appointed to review what was done and not done, they're going to conclude, I'm sure, that this event occurred for want of things that we could have done, that we knew how to do, that were affordable, that were physically possible to do, but that somehow or another we didn't get our act together to do. And I would say that's unacceptable. So if psychologically one can envisage what this event would be like, and then begin to think about what would I be doing the day after, the question is, why not to do that the day before?
America has a plan for such a disaster. In 2008, the Department of Homeland Security publishes the National Response Framework, our nation's most comprehensive plan to respond and survive any attack. In 2009, they went one step further. Monitoring the latest intelligence, they identify the top 15 threats facing our nation. An unpublished 92-page document breaks down the realities of national planning scenario number one, nuclear detonation. It's a threat that will kill hundreds of thousands, cost hundreds of billions, a threat that didn't die with the Cold War. Based on the latest intelligence, Doomsday will most likely be delivered by a terrorist armed with a 10-kiloton nuclear device. This nightmare scenario is the culmination of a 10-year effort. The rogue enemy smuggles in enough highly enriched uranium to construct a simple, gun-type improvised nuclear device. Mode of transport, delivery van. Estimated time of explosion, a weekday morning. Ground Zero, Washington, D.C.
The worst case scenario really is that a nuclear weapon could wipe out the entire leadership of the U.S. government.
The chaos that would result from 5 million people in the greater Washington metropolitan area, of which some substantial fraction would attempt to leave, get out of Dodge as fast as possible. The chaos that would result from that is almost impossible to imagine, other than to say it would be truly chaotic.
Is it possible Yes. Do we need to prepare for it? Absolutely.
Just minutes after detonation, the nation faces three major challenges. One, rescue the president or his next living successor. Two, save any survivors near Ground Zero. Three, determine existence of a second nuclear weapon and locate that weapon before it's too late. The highest levels of U.S. intelligence have identified the detonation of a nuclear bomb on U.S. soil, a top national security threat.
Today, the Cold War has disappeared, but thousands of those weapons have not. In a strange turn of history, the threat of global nuclear war has gone down, but the risk of a nuclear attack has gone up.
The attacks of 9/11 alter our government's disaster planning forever. The Department of Homeland Security ushers in sweeping changes. A national response framework lays out a clear chain of command and responsibilities, and 15 planning scenarios break down the exact nature of potential threats to the homeland.
One terrorist with one nuclear weapon could unleash massive destruction.
Planning scenario number one, detonation of a nuclear weapon in Washington, D.C. A 10-kiloton nuclear bomb, approximately the size of Hiroshima, explodes at the doorstep of the Capitol. A pressure wave crushes organs. Hurricane-force winds topple buildings. A 650-foot fireball incinerates Washington, D.C. Within seconds of the blast, the government launches multiple disaster plans.
There is no one magic plan. What there is there's a series of plans. There is a process of planification.
Improvised nuclear device is not a small event, and most people are immediately put into the most uncomfortable parts of their thinking when they think of those types of events. But, you know, simply put, being prepared ahead of time will save a lot of lives.
How do you prepare for the unthinkable? One zone at a time. Based on approximate distances from Ground Zero, these predictions enable planners to gauge the amount of damage in each zone. Damage zones are not an exact science, as a nuclear bomb has never exploded in the heart of an American city. Zone 1, the no-go zone. Zone 2, moderate damage zone. Zone 3, light damage zone. Zone 1, the no-go zone, 0.6 miles from Ground Zero. Satellite imagery shows the Capitol building in Zone 1 at Ground Zero.
Closest in, everything would be annihilated.
You're really talking about no structure standing, no survivability, nobody that you could visibly see, mounds and mounds of rubble from building collapses and things like that.
If anyone survives, the extreme radiation levels will kill them within hours.
There are some difficulties in the line of succession. One is that everyone in that line of succession lives and works in the Washington, D.C. area.
The majority of Congress is presumed dead, missing, or incapacitated. Zone 2, moderate damage zone, 0.6 miles to 1 mile from Ground Zero.
You may be able to clearly see some people moving around. Damage less extensive, but still significantly extensive.
There would be significant heat, and there would be fire. In the fire zones, those might spread very quickly because it would damage gas lines, it would damage water lines. There would be limited ability to prevent progression of flames and building damage from that.
The White House sits in Zone 3. The blast pressure blows out door and window frames. Most injuries are caused by shattered glass and flying debris.
Because so many critical decisions are going to have to be made, it will be critically important to identify just who is the senior surviving member of the chain of command.
worst case scenario is an attack that hits our leadership in a way that leaves a vacuum, either for someone to fill who's not legitimate, or possibly even for contenders to leadership, that there's a question of who really is in charge, both in the legislative and executive branch.
The line of succession ensures a clear chain of command. But who are the surviving links in that chain?
Our Constitution was drafted at a time where there were not weapons of mass destruction, where one could imagine a president, or maybe a president and a vice president, having an illness or being killed, but not that an attack could essentially wipe out all of the leadership of Washington at one time.
The oldest and most secretive part of the nation's plan attempts to address this nightmare scenario. It's called COG, Continuity of Government.
Continuity of Government, or COG, is the program that ensures that in the event that the American government faces a catastrophe, nuclear, chemical, biological, a terrorist attack, that the country does not descend into anarchy, that there is some hand of government that continues to rule and prevents the country from dissolving into chaos.
These plans are highly classified for good reason. The United States isn't going to telegraph to its adversaries how it would prepare for a major strike. This has always sort of been shrouded in the cloak of national security. You're talking about how the president, how the Secretary of Defense, how the Joint Chiefs wage a war, how do they survive a war.
Post-blast, the Joint Chiefs of Staff orders the U.S. military placed on the highest alert. DEFCON 1 sets military plans in motion. The mission? Prevent the decapitation of America's democracy. The Pentagon's Joint Emergency Evacuation Program shifts into high gear. Designated Department of Defense helicopters located near Washington remain on alert 24/7, 365 days a year. Upon detonation, they swoop in to pick up officials needed to maintain strategic direction and control of armed forces. Within minutes, they are airborne, heading for undisclosed radiation-proof continuity of government locations up and down the coast.
Their direct hit or near direct hit on the Capitol would essentially incinerate it, render it useless for governance, at least in the near term. So that meant that you had to remove government from the Capitol to some place outside of the blast zone. Planners and government were looking for hollowed out mountains, and they created facilities as a ring around the Capitol that was considered to be outside the blast zone, but close enough that senior government officials could reach it in the event of an impending attack.
Today, there are believed to be over 90 continuity of government evacuation sites within the federal arc, the 300-mile perimeter circling Washington, D.C. Location of these sites? Classified.
It's important to note when you're talking about COG that this isn't just protecting the president or the Supreme Court or the cabinet secretaries or the Congress. This is the notion of protecting the American government and the ability to administer government after the greatest catastrophe that we can imagine. But Eisenhower, for example, had virtually every agency and department of government earmarked with a specific place to go in the event of a nuclear war. The Federal Reserve had cash stockpiled outside the country to restart the economy. There were regulations, hundreds and hundreds of pages of regulations, for example, on how to deliver mail after a nuclear attack.
COGCON 1 is Continuity of Government Condition 1, and it's similar to the DEFCON system, or Defense Threat Condition. This would be the state that the government would be in the midst of an attack, and this would be what would trigger officials from government leaving Washington and going out to those secure sites and putting into effect the continuity of government plan that was established after 9/11.
DEFCON evacuates military leadership. COGCON evacuates civilian leadership. As for rank-and-file civilians,
at some point, within a few minutes, you will see this unmistakable, fearsome loathsome development of the mushroom cloud.
Oh my goodness.
Less than 20 minutes after the blast, the mushroom cloud will reach its maximum height of 14,000 feet and begin dumping deadly radioactive fallout. For those who survived the initial blast, the worst is yet to come.
You have your car, you have your children, you have your wife, you have your pets in the car with you, and you are backed up in traffic and it's not moving. And you know that there's a radiological plume out there somewhere and you don't know which way it's drifting. Are you going to just sit there like you would under normal circumstances and hoping that it's not drifting your way?
That radiological plume will soon spread out over a 20-mile area, creating the dangerous fallout zone, or DF zone. But 20 miles in which direction?
Bring it on in, bring it on in.
After 10 to 20 minutes, we're going to see the initial descent of radioactive debris from the mushroom cloud.
The last thing you want to do is have everybody on the road stuck in a traffic jam while the nuclear fallout is falling down on their vehicles.
Even if we lost 80,000 people in a nuclear detonation, how could we save the rest of the city's residents if we did a certain amount of preparedness by government and a certain amount of understanding and information given to the public? It could mean the difference between life and death for hundreds of thousands of people.
Dead. 15,000 wounded. A nuclear bomb detonated in the heart of Washington, D.C. The scenario U.S. intelligence has listed as one of our greatest national security threats.
I think it's important that the American people think the unthinkable. Unless you're willing to stare into the nuclear abyss and confront the magnitude and the significance of what nuclear weapons could do and the challenge of that civilization faces in dealing with that, you can't really appreciate what your government is being asked to do to work this problem.
Government officials have game planned this scenario for over 60 years. The threat of nuclear attack didn't die with the Cold War. It just changed shape.
During the Cold War, if there was an all-out nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States, it essentially meant the end of the planet. Terrorists are not going to have a nuclear arsenal of tens of thousands of weapons.
The consequences of nuclear terrorism are far less severe, they're far less dramatic, and they're far less extensive, obviously, than all-out nuclear war would have been.
In short, today's threat is a survivable nuclear war. The plans in place today reflect this reality. The Department of Homeland Security has created detailed attack scenarios and response guidelines.
The impact of a single nuclear weapon on Washington, D.C. is so profound that it has cascading impacts, not just in terms of decision-making that has to be done in the United States, but also on the psychological impact both in the United States and elsewhere in the world.
The bomb triggers a multi-tiered, well-practiced plan to save America.
What you are seeing is a very rapidly galvanized effort to do two things: try and secure the country from additional attacks, while at the same time trying to deal in an expedient fashion with the human disaster that would exist in and around the explosion itself.
Military leaders outside the Capitol prepare to lock down the nation. Their first order of business: Operation Skatana, shutting down America's airspace. Skatana was originally developed in the 1970s to clear the skies following confirmed warnings of an attack by the Soviet Union. The plan was last launched on 9/11. A call went out from a White House bunker. Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta gave the orders. 90 minutes later, 4,500 commercial planes in American airspace were sitting on tarmacs around the country.
In the event of a catastrophic nuclear strike, you'd see the Transportation Security Administration, which is part of Homeland Security, kind of come into action and to take steps to secure not just the airspace, but also trucking, shipping. Port authorities would come into play. If there were a nuclear detonation, there would be an assumption that it got in somehow through a port of entry or over the border. I think you would see a lot of the Homeland Security agencies, Border Protection, the Coast Guard, taking steps to really sort of seal off the country and go through a lot of that cargo as well. From the government standpoint, if a nuclear device went off in a major city, they would absolutely presume that there were more of them.
How can the president go on TV, if he's still alive, and say, I'm assuring you that there isn't another bomb? He won't know that. With one bomb already having gone off, who could be confident that that wasn't true?
Disaster planning rule number one. Security officials always assume there's a second bomb, and they never underestimate a terrorist.
If you look at the 9/11 Commission report, it says the principal failure of the U.S. government was, quote, a failure of imagination. So what was hard to imagine? That terrorists could hijack airplanes? Excuse me, they had hijacked airplanes before. Now, would the people who sponsored that act, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, have been happier if 300,000 people had been killed rather than 3,000? I think if you have any doubt about that, you should go look at the video that Osama bin Laden put out after the event, in which he describes how pleased he is with how successful this venture has been. And if you want to see where they want to go, look at the declaration by Al-Qaeda, in which they say their objective is to kill 4 million Americans, including 2 million children. You're not going to get there by hijacking airplanes and crashing them into buildings. So what's the top of that pyramid? It's a mushroom cloud enveloping an American city. If you look at the people who have had responsibility in the U.S. government and had full access to information about what is known about the intent and the activities of Al-Qaeda, there's no dispute whatever about the fact that this is where Al-Qaeda wants to go.
If there is a nuclear detonation in the city where you are, you really cannot count on emergency personnel getting anywhere near you for an extended amount of time.
First responders with the Washington, D.C. Fire Department are closest to the blast.
Well, some first responders obviously will be some of the casualties.
The D.C. Fire Department has 2,000 members. 8 of the 34 stations are less than 2 miles from ground zero.
The closest ones in, unfortunately, are going to be dead. The next ones will be victims and will be unrecognizable from the lay public in terms of the degree of trauma and burn that they would incur.
The United States doesn't suffer from lack of resources. There are more than 155,000 EMTs, 600,000 police officers, 1.6 million active duty military troops, and 1.1 million reserves and National Guard. Just tapping into 10% of federal resources equals a force the size of the entire population of St. Louis. FEMA coordinates this massive response effort. A component of the Department of Homeland Security, this is post-Katrina FEMA, a FEMA with a plan and a playbook. Less than half a mile from the blast zone, little is left of FEMA headquarters. Their continuity of operations backup plan is an alternate site. Location undisclosed.
We don't do the planning to have meetings. We do the planning to have the plans in place so that not only we have something to go to in a time of crisis, but those who replace us have something to go to in a time of crisis. Whether that's due to the fact that we've retired and moved on, or that we ourselves are casualties of whatever the incident may be.
What we can do from the federal government with regards to public health and medical support is we can bring people. We have close to 10,000 people who are regular full-time emergency room intensive care personnel who are organized into specialized teams that we call disaster medical assistance teams.
The nation's rapid response medical force receives federal travel orders. These civilian volunteers become federalized and are shipped towards the blast zone.
Those folks really are sitting on pins and needles on a day-to-day basis. That is, they know they're up and they may be called. So we were able to get them identified, get them travel, get them their equipment, get them their supplies, and move them downrange within 24 hours.
Many victims in the blast zone won't live that long. The next 60 minutes are critical. Without proper shelter and with radiation thick in the air, 100,000 people will become grim statistics before the end of this program.
This huge cylinder of dust and debris that arises from ground zero spreads out at the top, fairly high in the sky, becomes the mushroom cloud that we all remember that is the hallmark of a nuclear detonation. And on the other hand, you might be in a place where there's so much dust and debris that you don't really see much of anything. We'd like people to be aware of what they can do to maximize the chance of them living through this entire catastrophe if they survived the initial blast. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about preparedness for nuclear terrorism in modern society.
There's going to be a period of time where there is no communications with people who are surviving in an impacted area. So one of the key aspects of communication is, what do we tell them before an event?
I don't know how anybody could do this, but I have to give you this advice, is that you don't want to be looking in the direction of the initial flash of light. One can get temporarily blinded and sometimes permanently blinded by staring into a light which would be the equivalent of about a million suns. If you can remember to keep your mouth open, it allows the pressure on both sides of your eardrums to be equalized. If your mouth is closed, then all the pressure is going internally and it could burst your eardrums. But then after the blast, you want to try to keep your mouth not only closed, but actually protected if you can, with, if you had a face mask or cloth or anything that might help filter some of the radioactive materials from getting into your lungs.
High doses of radiation kill within hours. Others survive for weeks before their bodies shut down.
The problem with high doses of radiation is that it destroys the cells in the human body. You stop replenishing your blood supply, your white blood cells, which help protect against infection, and your red blood cells, which carry oxygen, die off and are not replaced. The lining in your intestinal tract, your stomach and your intestines, are very much affected by radiation. People get severe, overwhelming diarrhea and vomiting, and they become dehydrated and sometimes lethally, fatally dehydrated in a relatively short period of time. So the whole idea here is to get out of the hotly radioactive zones and into a safe zone or a shelter as quickly as possible.
But how do you know if your zone is safe? The threat of nuclear attack is greater today than ever. The U.S. government has game-planned what the day after will look like. The effects of a nuclear blast on an American city are broken down in chilling detail in recently published government documents.
If the nuclear attack happens on American soil, there's going to be no way to sugarcoat this. It's going to be bad.
A convoy of black SUVs and limos emerge from the destruction. Continuity of Government, or COG, the plan to prevent the decapitation of our democracy, is underway. The Secret Service is in charge of evacuating the president, if he's still alive.
There are evacuation plans, there are line of succession plans, and those provide us with a framework for operating the government in the face of all types of crises.
The Secret Service won't reveal any details of this evacuation plan. The current administration is not the first to think the unthinkable. 1955. Olmsted Air Force Base is a linchpin in President Eisenhower's continuity of government plan. Olmsted is home to the 2857th Test Squadron, an elite unit of helicopter pilots and crew taking part in the top-secret outpost mission. Strategically located 120 miles from Washington, D.C., Olmsted is well outside the perceived blast range of an atomic assault on the Capitol.
Outpost mission was a remarkable contingency plan. Their mission, in the event that Washington was hit with a nuclear weapon, was to get in a helicopter, suited out with radiation uniforms, shovels, materials and equipment, and they were to head for the White House and dig the president and first family out of the bunker from the White House, which had presumably collapsed around them in the nuclear attack, and then to take them on board a helicopter to an underground site where they would be safe. I know nothing about what that plan is today, except that there is a plan.
Seconds after the first plane hits, America's 21st century continuity of government plan unfolds before the nation's eyes.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the president, Cheney, Rumsfeld, all of the senior officials in government pulled out those files that had been waiting in their safes all those years and implemented the program. It clearly had its roots in the COG plans of Eisenhower.
The vice president was taken to a bunker underneath the White House. The national security advisor went there as well. And they tried to establish lines of communications with the Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon, who goes into his own kind of secure location. And they also tried to establish communications with Air Force One so that this whole national command authority was talking to each other. The president obviously was in Florida when the attacks occurred. He was not brought back to Washington. He was put on Air Force One. Nobody knew on board, short of the pilots and the president, I suppose, where they were going.
People criticized the president for being absent, but that was a call that had been made in some ways years, even decades earlier. This was not a drill. This was the real thing.
Air Force One transforms into a flying Oval Office.
A place where he could effectively go run the country and run a war as he's flying around the skies. I think those were sort of artifacts of the Cold War, you know, the kind of things that you would maybe more even associate with, you know, Tom Clancy novels or something. And after 9/11, it became so real.
On the ground, chaos.
I'll never forget seeing the images and the video of staffers running out of the White House and the Secret Service just yelling to people, go, run, take off your shoes, don't turn around, just keep running. That's not what we think of when we think of continuity of government and sort of the orderly evacuation of the city. People fled. So the key leaders were, you know, protected and put in place. What people realized is that that wasn't going to be enough, that if you're going to avoid mass panic in the city, particularly if the attack had been worse, if there had been many planes, or if there had been a biological attack, a chemical attack, a nuclear attack, that it was going to take some more orderly planning. What are you going to do with these several million people to get them out of here?
9/11 reveals gaps in our nation's plan, holes that have since been filled by the Department of Homeland Security. But a nuclear weapon exploding at the Capitol's doorstep will require much more than improved evacuation plans. Evacuees need to know which way the fallout is heading, or they risk running directly towards their doom. It's the job of the Interagency Modeling Atmospheric and Assessment Center to provide this life-saving info. Minutes post-blast, they get the call from DHS. Their mission? Map the deadly plume. Their prediction creates a new zone, the DF, or Dangerous Fallout Zone. The plume spreads out over 20 miles. Based on rapidly changing atmospheric wind conditions, most in this zone are far enough away from the initial blast to survive. They're unaware they may soon become casualties.
Theoretically, you have 15 or 20 minutes to get yourself farther away from the initial blast zone. So you want to move in the opposite direction, upwind of the nuclear detonation, or at crosswinds perpendicular to where the wind is going.
Simply relying on wind direction can be a deadly mistake.
Very quickly, no matter what the type of event, there are local public health officials who get on the media and attempt to deliver good information.
Government laboratories continue to map the plume, providing up-to-the-second wind conditions and plume direction. The information is quickly disseminated. 37 pre-selected radio stations broadcast official emergency messages across the nation. These stations are known as primary entry points, or PEP stations. FEMA equips them with emergency generators. Electricity is knocked out across Washington, D.C. and the surrounding area. Only people with hand crank radios will hear the dire warnings.
If you have no means to receive the message, then you'll never hear the message.
We're frankly being more creative about the way we can push information out to the public through things like Facebook and Twitter and other technologies.
DC Homeland Security Emergency Management Agency has Twitter capabilities to be able to provide that information. But at the end of the day, when those things aren't working, having somebody go door to door knocking on door, having a police patrol car go through the neighborhood with their PA speaker are all the things that are going to have to be utilized.
But how does a first responder enter the hot zone without risking his own life?
You got to try to very quickly wrap your hands around what area of the city you can begin to impact to do the most good for the most amount of people. And equally as critical and probably more difficult from a leadership position would be to have to make the very quick determination what group of people or what geographical area you're not going to help.
The wind dumps deadly radioactive fallout for miles. National laboratories attempt to stay ahead of the plume. A top-secret government evacuation is underway. Meanwhile, the threat of a second attack looms.
If a nuclear bomb went off in an American city, America and the world would be changed forever, and not for the better. For one thing, I am sure that either those who carried out the attack or someone else would call up and say, we've got 5 more nuclear bombs, or we've got 10 more nuclear bombs, and they're already hidden in American cities, and we're going to start setting them off unless you do what we want. And they would make that threat public, and people would start fleeing the major cities with one bomb already having gone off. Who could be confident that that wasn't true? The potential for chaos is immense in this kind of a situation.
NEST, the Nuclear Emergency Search Team, springs into action. Made up of scientists and terrorism experts, NEST members are stationed across the country. Their job? Seek out loose nukes around the globe. On 9/11, NEST team members began to mobilize before the second tower fell. The U.S. government created NEST in 1974.
Now, you have to understand the context at the time.
He has pulled a hand grenade, Ted, and he is ready to blow up the aircraft if he has to. We must land at Beirut.
Terrorists at the time were taking hostages. They were hijacking airliners, they were kidnapping diplomats, they were taking over embassies all around the world in order to make political demands. So the analysts thought, well, what if we simply scale that up, and what if instead of holding passengers of an airplane hostage, they had a weapon of mass destruction and held a city hostage?
NEST can dispatch 7-man response teams in less than 2 hours. There are believed to be 400 members nationwide, stationed in a dozen strategic locations. Donning plain clothes and equipped with radiation detectors disguised as briefcases, NEST searches for the equivalent of a nuclear needle in a haystack. From their base camp in New Mexico, they are activated by the Department of Homeland Security. Operation Flynest gives them priority over airspace. A specially equipped Air Force plane can carry up to 200 Nest team members and up to 68,000 pounds of cargo to target cities around the nation. Post-blast, the plane is loaded with large detectors that they will soon mount discreetly in the back of rental vans. The plane is loaded with Nest helicopters that will soon be hovering over strategic ports and bridges looking for the loose nuke. Their mission? Assist the FBI in finding and disarming the next bomb before it's too late.
Both before 9/11, but especially since 9/11, they've been called out very frequently, and the U.S. government has invested in beefing up their capabilities since 9/11.
October 2001. Nest receives a credible report from a CIA agent codenamed Dragonfire. An Al-Qaeda-backed nuclear attack on New York City is imminent. Hundreds of plainclothes Nest members flood the streets of Manhattan.
A month to the day after 9/11, the director of CIA goes in to see the president with the president's daily intelligence briefing and reports that Dragonfire has issued a report that says that Al-Qaeda has gotten a small nuclear bomb out of the former Soviet arsenal. It's brought that bomb to the U.S. and now has it in New York City and may be about to explode it. The president catches his breath, and then there's an interrogatory that goes something like the following. Did the former Soviet arsenal include bombs of the description? Answer, yes. Were all those bombs in the former Soviet arsenal adequately accounted for? Answer, no. Could Al-Qaeda have acquired one of these weapons? Answer, yes. Could Al-Qaeda have brought that weapon to New York City and be about to explode it? Answer, yes. So the bottom line from this interrogatory was that there was no basis for denying Dragonfire's report that Al-Qaeda now had a nuclear bomb in New York City and might be about to explode it. If today one received a high-quality report of the same thing about a bomb in Chicago or Los Angeles or Boston or New York, you would have no basis for saying that could not be happening. The fact is that that could be happening.
Some experts believe it's not if, but when.
It's now thought that somebody with a certain level of education, let's say a bachelor's or master's degree in physics, with an interest in nuclear physics and an interest in making a nuclear weapon, could lead a team of people to actually construct a nuclear weapon if they had in their possession a sufficient amount of nuclear material that would be required.
Today, there is enough material in the world for 250,000 nuclear weapons. It only takes one to wipe out DC.
If you ask the question, which places in the world should I worry about the most? Russia, Pakistan, and these civilian research reactors that are using highly enriched uranium as their fuel.
Russia has the world's largest stockpile of weapons and materials spread out over 11 time zones. When the Iron Curtain fell in 1989, that stockpile was suddenly up for grabs.
The nuclear workers weren't getting paid for 6 months at a time. The budgets for these nuclear facilities collapsed, and in many cases they ended up with gaping holes in their fences. Very often they had no detector at all at the door to set off an alarm if someone was carrying plutonium out in their briefcase.
The level of corruption that accompanied the collapse of the Soviet Union is almost impossible to exaggerate. The saying was, everything's for sale. And virtually everything was for sale.
Faulty accounting provided opportunity. The potential to make millions, or for some, just to put dinner on the table, provided motive.
One of the workers at this particular facility knew that the accounting system at the facility was set up so that as long as output was within a couple of percent of input, it was considered normal losses to waste, and nobody would check. So he kept stealing small amounts of highly enriched uranium. And eventually he had stolen 1.5 kilograms of 90% enriched, that is bomb-grade highly enriched uranium. He was eventually caught. And he has said that he really wanted to get enough money to buy a new refrigerator and a new washing machine for his family. The bad news about nuclear terrorism can be framed as the answers to several key questions. First, do terrorists want nuclear weapons? Unfortunately, it's clear the answer is yes. Second, is it possible if terrorists got the needed nuclear material, they could make a nuclear bomb? The answer there is also yes. Third, is it possible that terrorists could get highly enriched uranium or plutonium? Unfortunately, here too, the answer is yes.
The question is, how about the cases that we don't know about? So it's what we don't know about that should worry us more.
The material needed to build a bomb is small enough to fit in a suitcase.
So if I could just show you what we're talking about here. So if we had a supply of uranium, highly enriched uranium, that was dimensionally more or less like this. It would be very heavy because the mass is heavy, so maybe it would be 75 pounds, but it could fit on my lap.
Once it walks out the door of the facility where it's supposed to be, it could be anywhere, and it's very difficult to recover it, retrieve it, stop somebody from doing something with it, and stop them from delivering it into a major country.
9 million shipping containers enter our ports each year. Studies indicate only 5% are inspected before they are unloaded, often onto trains, trucks, or vans headed into the heart of any city in the country.
As one of my former colleagues who's been chancellor at UCLA likes to tease, if you have any doubt about terrorists' ability to bring a nuclear bomb to an American city like Los Angeles, think about it. They could always hide it in a bale of marijuana, which we know comes to Los Angeles.
Civilization will live forever with the possibility that some Russian has 200 pounds of plutonium-239 in his basement and put it there in 1989 and is waiting to see who the biggest bidder is for the material in some point in the future.
Some experts believe the future has already arrived.
We're all shocked. Nuclear weapon. This is an urgent health message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Nuclear weapon has been exploded. Local, state, and federal officials, including HHS, FBI, and Homeland Security, or emergency personnel, will be. Remember, you cannot see, feel, or taste radiation. You may not know if you've been exposed.
The threat of nuclear attack is now greater than ever.
9/11 really focused the nation on the threat of terrorism and opened our eyes to the scope of things for which we should be prepared.
America's preparation for a nuclear attack is laid out in chilling detail in this document. Published in January 2009, this is the government's most comprehensive plan yet. The playbook begins with a hypothetical attack based off the latest intelligence. A 10-kiloton crude nuclear weapon, ground delivered by a terrorist to the heart of an American city.
It's important to understand that for the first 24 hours, it is red lights and sirens.
It's all hands on deck. We're going to be rushing resources to the region where this has occurred.
The nation's plan for nuclear attack lists the fire department as the lead agency on the ground.
These incidents start and end local. But it is built at the lowest level at the local responder and then moves up in progression to a more significant federal and military response.
The Washington, D.C. Fire Department sets up the IC, or Incident Command. The incident commander is the eyes on the ground. Based on the blast zones, he establishes perimeters.
We respond with a strict set of standard operating guidelines. And so you get to the scene, you isolate the area, you deny entry to anybody, and then you begin to put your plan in effect.
The plan must account for mass casualties. No prior warning of attack. A rescue mission undertaken while radiation hangs thick in the air.
The important part of that is that because an IND is so complex and has not been experienced in the United States, we have a system, if you will, that regardless of the confusion, regardless of the impact, for lack of a better term, fails safe to.
On the ground, Incident Command begins to implement a system straight from the pages of America's nuclear playbook. It's a mass casualty medical response called RTR, Radiation, Triage, Transport, and Treatment System. Its goal, to organize the rescue effort by bringing people and assets as close as physically possible to victims.
There's really two main goals that we have, and it really becomes that simple. And that is the safety and survival of the victims of the incident, and obviously the protection of first responders.
RTR-1 sites are erected closest to the epicenter. Victims processed here are most severe. RTR-2 sites are located on the outer edges of the dangerous fallout zone and in the low damage zone. RTR-3 sites are designated collection points. Victims at these sites are transported to secondary locations away from the danger zones. Pre-selected hospitals and burn units serve as medical care sites. Displaced persons and those not in urgent need of care gather at assembly centers. The largest people-moving operation in America's history is underway.
What if we use up all the ambulances that we have here in the local environment? On a larger event, we're reliant on National Guard and Department of Defense assets. But in some events, the airframes of the Department of Defense are tied up in other activities. Iraq and Afghanistan continue to demand great asset expenditure. So one of the things that we've thought about is there is a civilian reserve air fleet. The domestic air carriers will free up aircraft and provide those for patient transportation. We have to think about all the eventualities, and we have to think about how we would employ all these possible assets to the best advantage.
The plan doesn't answer all the questions. The plan doesn't make you act like a gentleman when things are going really bad. The plan does lay a foundation for you to begin your response on.
All right, move on to the next set.
Good.
Part of this foundation is SEABIRTH, America's Chemical Biological Incident Response Force.
SEABIRTH is unique in the fact that I have no other task to do other than to train and prepare for the worst thing that could ever possibly happen to this country. And that's all I have to do.
We are capable of operating at a higher level of personal protective equipment and doing some of these tech rescue operations at higher levels than any other element within the Department of Defense.
SEABIRTH takes orders on site from the local incident commander. They sector off a neighborhood and enter the hot zone. It remains to be seen whether those in the hot zone will survive long enough to be rescued.
The whole trick about surviving from the radiation effects of a nuclear explosion has to do with time, distance, and protection.
Time, radiation decays. Distance, effects are less severe as you get farther away from the hot zone. Protection, much like a lead blanket worn during an X-ray, certain structures provide adequate protection. For now. As data pours in from each zone to national laboratories, the question for disaster planners becomes, to evacuate or not evacuate? Is it better to expose survivors to high doses of radiation for a short time and evacuate? Or are their chances of survival increased by spending days exposed to lower doses in a relatively protected building?
the fact of the matter is that there are going to be people who don't survive this type of incident. I think the surprising thing that people should know is there will be plenty of people that do survive this type of incident.
But how?
Many people could be saved by simply sheltering in place or staying where they are in the safest building possible in order to avoid any fallout.
250,000 people are instructed to shelter in place while the plume is on the move. This doesn't mean pick up your kids at school first. There are 75,000 school children in the capital region. Parents who survive the blast and then rush to schools to pick up their children risk further exposure and death.
In this crisis, the greatest risk from fallout is very early after a device. So the best thing to do is to have children sheltered in place in their schools with school systems that are prepared for that, and parents sheltering in place where they are.
If you're in your car, you have about 10 to 20 minutes to get out of your car and go into a building where you're protected as much as possible, either in the basement or in the center core of that building. Being in a car is better than being out in the open. Being out in the open is the most dangerous place to be. If you're in the open and you're flat against a building, that's better than being in the open, say, in the middle of the street, because the parts of you that are flat against the building are not going to be catching as much radiation.
Tens of thousands lay injured in zones 1 and 2, but radiation exposure may be the least of their worries.
People will unfortunately have other injuries to deal with as well. People will be burned. People may be injured by flying glass or flying debris. So there'll be traumatic injury, burn injury, radiation injury. And this won't be easy. This will be the most difficult thing for most people that they ever have done in their entire lives.
This is America under attack. The threat of anarchy and a second bomb hangs over every major U.S. city. National planning scenario number 1. A declaration of martial law may be considered. The Capitol is now a fiery 30-foot deep crater. The unthinkable has happened. National planning scenario number 1. Come to life. With DC burning, can we stop the next one before another American city goes up in flames? The government orders precautionary mass evacuations in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. DC's beltway is clogged. Its tunnels, bridges are inaccessible. The metro has been badly damaged. There are blinded drivers, chaos, panic. It's unlike anything Americans have ever seen.
There will be a certain number of them that will choose to shelter in place, and they'll pull that duct tape out and dutifully stick it to their windows and their doors. But there's going to be a large percentage of Americans that are going to say, honey, let's get in the car and let's get out of here.
On any given weekday morning, more than 5 million people inhabit Washington, D.C. and the surrounding areas. With tourists and visiting students, the population swells to 7 million. In national planning scenario number 1, this is the time of detonation.
When you look at, say, just 25% of 7 million would evacuate, you can work the math. Let's just say only 10% find their way into West Virginia. That's 700,000 people. 700,000 people coming at the same time in a very short period of time into a state of only 1.8 million. How could our infrastructure support that?
A shell-shocked stream of contaminated evacuees pour into surrounding states.
It would be like having a home for a family of 4 and having 400 for dinner, but then have them stay for breakfast and lunch and dinner for the next 2 to 3 weeks or months. How do you handle that?
thousands are expected to ignore warnings to shelter in place.
I think at the core of who we are as humans is the ultimate need to protect your family. And I think we could tell people lots of things that they should or shouldn't do to protect their family, and whether they heed the advice or not, to some extent, is out of our control. Obviously, nobody's going to benefit from anybody getting in their car and clogging up the roadways. People absolutely have to know. They won't stand for not having the information to understand how to deal with the issue.
Then there are those that can't leave. They're trapped, burned, in shock. According to the zoned response, for the next few days, the no-go zone and the dangerous fallout zone are deemed too hazardous for first responders to enter. 100,000 will die in the next 12 hours while waiting for help that never comes.
If you make attempts to go in there, not only are your efforts going to prove minimal, but you're going to put your personnel in extreme danger.
The amount of radiation that would be down that area would just be too severe.
Rescue operations focus on zones 2, 3, and beyond. Victims fit enough to walk flood out of the hot zones to RTR sites. Search and extraction Marines head in.
Communication at all times. Teamwork, talk to each other, all right?
They work with local responders to extricate victims from the rubble. SEABIRF isn't the only Title 10 military force on the scene, but they are the most highly trained for such an attack. SEABIRF drills year-round in preparation for a chemical or bio attack on the homeland. Stationed just 20 miles from D.C., initially they can bring 130 specially trained Marines and sailors to the fight. A second IRF, or Incident Response Force, will arrive in the next 24 hours. The rest of the 350-man battalion flies in from around the world within the next 48 hours. They've seen combat in Iraq, Afghanistan. Today, Washington, D.C. is their war zone.
You ready to go?
I think the thing that's probably most important for people to realize is that this is a life-saving organization. What we do here is really built around a capability to go into what we call a hot zone, a contaminated environment, with our search and extraction teams, and pull out victims.
As they go, they're looking underneath desks. They're looking in drawers for a baby that may have been, you know, stuck inside of a drawer. They don't just look in the room and walk out.
350 SEABIRF Marines. Hundreds of thousands of casualties. Rescuers descending upon the blast zone face long and daunting odds.
One of the things that we train on here at SEABIRF is living with and making hard decisions. So we've got to be smart about where we go down in the hot zone and try to pick as much low-hanging fruit as we possibly can early, minimize the amount of exposure that our Marines and sailors take early on in the operation so that we can keep using our Marines and sailors in these operations so that they don't culminate early by reaching a dosage on their dosimeter that makes them combat ineffective and no longer authorized to go downrange.
Exposure to more than 100 rads of radiation renders a SEABIRF troop combat ineffective. SEABIRF Marines wear dosimeters to track exposure. At 45 rads, the dosimeter starts beeping, alerting them it's time to turn back to the cold zone. Depending on radiation levels in the zone in which they're operating, they have minutes before they're in the red.
I just know the Marines and sailors in this unit, and I know if they can see another two or three victims or they know that there's somebody else down there, they'll take personal risk in order to try to save another American.
Three. One, two, three. Once the search and extraction Marines find that casualty, they'll pull them out of the building, move them to what we call our casualty collection point. That's where we have another set of doctors, or corpsmen, back there that are doing continuing triage and continuing stabilization as required.
There are a few things more uncomfortable to talk about than triage for people who have dedicated their lives and their professions to saving people and helping people.
A military casualty sorting system called DIME, delayed, immediate, minimal, and expectant, places victims in four categories.
How are we going to care for people who have lots of radioactive material on them or in them, but also have a severe burn or a terrible crushing abdominal injury? We're going to have challenges that hardly anybody in our first responder community has ever seen.
Like a war zone, a colored tag is assigned. A black tag means morgue or expectant. These patients have received massive doses of radiation and typically have third-degree burns over 25% of their body. No amount of life-saving treatment will save them.
Some of them would have injuries that were too extensive to benefit from any emergency surgeries or other treatment, and unfortunately, those people were not going to make it.
A red tag means a patient needs immediate surgery. These victims suffer massive hemorrhaging, crushed extremities, and ruptured internal organs. Reds quickly change to black if the tools or personnel to perform life-saving surgery aren't available.
We don't have enough burn beds in the United States of America in totality to cover the potential number of people with burns that we'd see in a single nuclear detonation in a single American city. So we don't have enough respirators. We don't have enough of virtually anything to provide the kind of care that we would need if it was just one individual requiring very specific care to respond to trauma and other emergencies.
Yellow means delayed treatment. A green tag, minimal injuries.
In the event of a nuclear detonation, people would be given a potassium iodide preparation, likely would be in tablet form. There are stores of those medications available within communities, and the local health system would know how to access that. Those would be given to people who potentially would be exposed to radioactive fallout, and those within the blast zone and a radiation zone to prevent thyroid damage related to the radiation exposure. The potassium iodide could be distributed at community collection points, churches, schools, hospitals, fire stations. They could use a variety of mechanisms, or they could request the assistance of a group like the U.S. Postal Service to deliver it house to house.
A key part of the plan, fatality management. Handling the thousands of casualties is one of the most demanding aspects of the nuclear detonation response.
We can bring to bear what are called DMORTs, or disaster mortuary assistance teams.
Morticians and forensic experts are flown in. Portable disaster morgues located along the coast are activated. They are tasked with the grim job of processing the dead. Night falls. Thousands more people remain trapped in the rubble. As the casualty count continues to rise, the question remains: is the president, vice president, anyone in our national command authority among the living or the dead? An eerie quiet descends upon Ground Zero. Meanwhile, the nation's continuity of government plan is underway. National Command Authority assembles underground. Their location, strictly classified.
Most of the people that were involved with COG had no illusions about how well it would work. But as they say, the perfect is the enemy of the good, they felt compelled nonetheless to come up with the best that they could.
Post-blast, officials report to secure underground COG locations, launching points for life after a nuclear holocaust. There are many sites, but there is one rumored to have played a critical role in every COG plan over the last 50 years. The U.S. government has requested that the name and location of this site remain secret.
It was where the president would go. It was where the Supreme Court would go. It was where the cabinet secretaries would go. And it was a hollowed-out mountain, and it had a special stone. It was very hard, very durable. It had air filters. It had, I think, two ponds inside that provided fresh water for those that were living there. They had triage, people coming in if they were exposed to radiation. They had the ability to cremate bodies.
With the exception of officials now running the government, this top secret site would be under lockdown.
There were weapons at the ready to ensure security and stability at the site. That is, if you had 1,000 locals rushing the facility and there were only provisions inside for, say, 1,200 people, and there were already 1,500 government people in there, you could not allow the townspeople to go in.
Special ID cards were necessary to gain access. But once inside, survival was not guaranteed.
One of the first things that would happen when you arrived is that you would be subjected to a dosimeter to measure how much radiation you'd been exposed to. And if you were gravely ill and there was little prospect for saving you, you had to be triaged in the worst case scenarios. And there were toe tags available, and people would be separated out depending upon the gravity of their exposure to radiation.
Plans were in place to scour down radiation victims in decontamination showers. Their clothes incinerated.
There's always been controversy about COG, because the idea is to preserve government after an attack. But what kind of government? There are other controversies about how carefully we would preserve and respect democracy and the Constitution in the wake of a nuclear attack.
Martial law was part of Eisenhower's original COG plan.
The greatest enemy, other than the enemy that had attacked America, was chaos and anarchy. Eisenhower, in helping to formulate and oversee these COG plans, had misgivings, and it pained him grievously to help formulate, oversee, and approve these contingency plans, which would erode our basic freedoms. You talked at one point about the country possibly descending into one large camp, a military camp.
Above ground, the threat of anarchy is real. Martial law is declared.
Once people experience what happens when a city goes up in flames from a nuclear bomb, people are going to demand a complete, almost, abolition of civil liberties. People are going to want to have searches everywhere to make sure that this doesn't happen again. It's going to change America in a very profound way, and I think change the world in a very profound way that I think most people would not like to see.
The 1980s. Reagan's continuity of government plans reflect his fear of a nuclear Armageddon. Like today, there are plans for sealing up borders and locking down ports through martial law. But Reagan's plan takes COG to a new level.
He put COG on steroids. He invested a tremendous amount of money in it. He seemed to believe that it was not just essential, but an essential priority.
Under Reagan's plan, legal rules of succession are set aside. Instead, a secretly pre-selected group of government insiders would quickly step forward to lead. These plans are strictly confidential.
Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster?
Mr. Chairman?
I believe that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area. So may I request that you not touch upon that, sir.
When the Iron Curtain fell, details of Reagan's elaborate COG plan began to emerge. Reports suggest the administration practiced this plan at least once a year. In the middle of the night, three teams are sent from Washington to undisclosed COG sites, nuclear-proof military command posts where they'll run the war. Lead-lined vans full of communication equipment and gear follow close behind them. Depending on the time of year the blast were to occur, one team is on call. If the president and vice president are killed or incapacitated, the top-ranking cabinet official of the team on call becomes the acting president. Reagan's teams are made up of 40 to 60 carefully selected representatives from the Department of State, Defense, and the CIA. A skeleton crew of apocalyptic, non-elected leaders. Key players in Reagan's highly classified COG plan are Dick Cheney, a Republican congressman, and business executive Donald Rumsfeld.
A president doesn't exist in a vacuum. A president who has some experienced leadership from that prior administration left over, some people to advise, and some ways of protecting that leadership were very important.
Once safely underground, the top-ranking cabinet official accesses Reagan's COG plans. The new leader of the free world proves his legitimacy in dramatic fashion. He calls up a submarine from the depths of the sea. A sign the acting president has complete command and control over all U.S. military forces. A non-elected leader. Legal rules of succession set aside. A Congress that won't be reconstituted after the attack. Reagan's plan was controversial, and much is still highly classified. His goal was to create a clear chain of command. Some call it a shadow government, one that could immediately stand up and respond to the minute-to-minute demands of nuclear war.
The notion of a shadow government makes a lot of people paranoid. They see conspiracy behind it, and they think of people governing in a way that we're not aware of, a shadow government. But in fact, they're a contingency there. They're there just in case, but their actual power does not come into being until there's a calamity.
October 2001. Bush enacts part of his COG plan. Dozens of selected officials are sent to live and work underground outside of the Capitol 24 hours a day. The officials represent every cabinet department and various independent agencies. They rotate every 90 days.
These are people who are not political appointees, but actually are career civil servants who work through different presidential administrations and have been tapped to sort of be the backup government if something catastrophic happens. And they would go out to these physical protected sites, some of them built into mountains, and that's where they would do their work. There's always been sort of that blanket over it, which kind of adds to the mystique and makes people wonder, I think justifiably so, well, what are the plans and what is the government trying to do aside from just evacuating officials from Washington?
What are the plans? It's a question that will forever go unanswered. One thing is certain. There is a plan to keep the nation's democracy intact should America's worst nightmare become reality.
We know that the threat is out there. We know that the planners of COG are readying to respond to the next attack should it come, just as those of us that grew up in the Cold War knew that within a matter of an hour or even a matter of minutes, the world as we knew it could come to a very abrupt and violent end with a nuclear attack. But we go on. COG is there in case of a catastrophe, in case of a calamitous attack, nuclear, chemical, biological. It's my personal belief that terrorists can't extinguish America, even if they got possession of a nuclear weapon. They only win if we ourselves extinguish those constitutional protections and freedoms. If through fear they induced us to snuff out our basic freedoms, they would have effectively destroyed us. COG must protect the continuity of government, but as an equal priority, it must protect our freedoms. It's who we are.
Washington, D.C., 24 hours earlier. 7 million people have no idea their lives are about to be changed forever. Now D.C. is burning. Just under 300,000 dead. Over 650,000 injured. 700,000 have evacuated.
There would be a need to assign blame for this. If something as catastrophic as a nuclear attack on a major U.S. city, I don't think the public would accept the answer of, we just don't know who did it and we'll never know.
There's a great deal of research that is going on in the area of nuclear forensics. That is, can we tell by the nature of the fallout, by the analysis of the radioactivity, where that nuclear material came from, and can we hold those persons responsible or that country responsible for the act of nuclear terrorism? It's entirely possible that terrorists, were they to fabricate a nuclear device, might have material from multiple sources. It's also possible this could be a deliberate spoof, that is, people could want to provoke us into retaliating against a particular country. So there's an argument about, can we determine who did it?
News of the bomb sends shockwaves throughout the world.
Pakistan may worry that we might take measures to disarm Pakistan. North Korea might get worried. Israel, in fact, has the planes on the runway and is loading up. We have, all over the world, missiles coming up to launch. This could be something like the Guns of August in 1914, where it took about 30 days from the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo to the beginning of World War I. Except today, those 30 days would be compressed into probably less than 30 hours.
The decisions made by the now assembled National Command Authority from their subterranean bunker have a ripple effect across the globe. The world is watching and waiting for America's response.
It's entirely possible that terrorists, were they to fabricate a nuclear device, might have material from multiple sources. So we might get it wrong. Now, there are others who will argue it doesn't make any difference that in a post-nuclear terrorist world, we have to be prepared to quickly remove the sources of future threats so that this is not retaliation. This is an opportunity.
When I was in the government and I had a lot of responsibility for some of the programs for improving security for nuclear material, I would often wake up in the middle of the night, essentially in a cold sweat, worrying that we weren't moving fast enough and we weren't doing enough and the terrorists were going to get to the nuclear material before we managed to get the security measures in place.
Poorly guarded facilities, an unregulated black market, miles of porous borders. Many officials believe this deadly pipeline can be stopped. This nightmare, preventable.
Why is it preventable? Because there's a happy syllogism in physics. No fissile material, no explosion that produces a mushroom cloud, no nuclear terrorism. Terrorists are not going to make fissile material. They're going to get fissile material from a state that's made it.
The U.S. government spends billions to secure the world's fissile material.
Now about 75% of the Russian arsenal and material has been secured to, I wouldn't say gold standards, but in any case, a pretty good copper standard.
By 2013, 100% of Russia's arsenal is expected to be locked down.
And with all the confusion, all the chaos, all of the corruption that accompanied the collapse of the Soviet Union, how many of the treasures in the Kremlin armory, where they keep their icons, the treasures of the state, how many have been lost? Answer, zero. For Americans, how much gold has been stolen from Fort Knox? Not 1 ounce, not 1 ounce. So human beings know how to lock up things we don't want people to steal. So I think all nuclear weapons, all nuclear material, everywhere, ought to be locked up as good as gold, and where it can't be locked up should be eliminated and taken out.
I don't want to be thinking through what we do when the smoke is rising from the destruction of a major American city. I really want to focus on making sure that that day after never comes.
I say to some of my younger colleagues, sure, it's an albatross once you get it around your neck and realize what a threat it is that's out there. But at the same time, you can get a lot of satisfaction out of working on this problem.
But is it too late?
You might say the concerns about nuclear weapons being used has come back with a vengeance. Not to be too cute about it, that it's Sex in the City terms, whether nuclear weapons might become the Manolo Blahniks of the 21st century, where everybody's got to have them.
Pakistan, North Korea, Iran, Al-Qaeda, the nuclear club may be growing.
There's a quantum of uncertainty that keeps all of these stories alive. No one can prove that something has not occurred, and so every statement that we make must be accompanied by the statement, insofar as we know. I mean, I can provide no guarantees that terrorists have not acquired fissile material.
People always ask, well, how big a risk is this? What's the probability that terrorists would really be able to set off a nuclear bomb in Washington or in New York? Short answer is nobody knows the answer to that question. There are people who say that that risk is more than 50% over the next 10 years. But even a 1% chance is enough to motivate a huge effort to prevent that from happening. If a nuclear bomb went off in an American city, America and the world would be changed forever, and not for the better. We really have to focus like a laser on prevention, on making sure that that day never comes.
And if it does, if the unthinkable happens, if planning scenario number one becomes a reality, is America prepared for the day after disaster?
You are tuned in to the Tando Radio Show on Black Talk Radio Network. Have a question or comment? Give us a call at 641-715-3660. That's 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND, 549-032-POUND. To signal the host, hit *61. Now back to Dave and the Tando Radio Show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Tando Radio Show. Hey, I love that promo. That's tight. I like that one, Scotty. This way I won't mess up the number anymore. Give us a call, 641-715-3660, and the participant code is 549032-POUND, and hit *61. Hey, listen, it's so important. I played that for a reason, and I want to go over the things. And we're going to talk about this in detail. It's a very long one, but it was too important to look over. And the reason why I wanted to play it was I wanted you to hear from the people that participated in that documentary for the History Channel. It was the RAND Corporation. It was FEMA. It was the fire department. It was all kinds of agencies. And so this was nothing more than government verification of what they're thinking. And let me tell you, I hope you picked up what they were really saying between the lines. Even though that they were compartmentalized people, if you really listen to it, and I posted it inside of Tandy, I want you to check it out again. What they're really telling you is this: COG, continuity of government, supersedes everything. And if you think about history, let's look at some real facts here. This is not conspiracy theory. And they smashed all the conspiracy theories in the world for people who don't realize what a conspiracy is. They basically told you that they participate in it daily. And how did they do that? They did that by this. They told you about a shadow government. That was an admission to a shadow government. From the COG plan, where it would be unelected officials that would take over. That should be something that should concern you above and beyond all things. And it brings all of this, you know, they tell you, everything they tell you is in plain sight. They tell you everything if you just learn to listen. They said that Reagan instituted that shadow government, but that's been around forever. But they just have to tell you before they do everything. One of the most important historical facts that is the truth that you have to look at, and you have to be a purveyor of truth. You have to be someone that wants to know the truth regardless of where it leads. The truth of the matter is this: the single most heinous terrorist crime against humanity has been done during this century. And it was done by, within this past 100 years, it was done by the United States government in dropping two nuclear devices, dropping the atomic bomb in Japan. And if you know the definition of a terrorist act, you see why. if you know the definition of it. So now, what does this tell you? They basically told you that the continuity of government and the shadow government rules everything, and that's all that really matters. They also said that that won't be instituted until a calamity happens. What does that tell you? Means, motive, and opportunity. Who has the means to bring that type of calamity? Who has the motives to bring that type of calamity? Who has the opportunity to do it? It's all the same usual suspects. Talked about Rumsfeld, talked about Cheney. And if you really look at what they're telling you, that they're going to do it themselves. They're giving you all the indications and tell you need to prepare, because I'm going to tell you, everything that they have prepared is for them. There is no continuity of the general public to remain in control of anything, because you're not in control of anything. Now, what would that offer them? It would offer the corporations, now that Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has been reached yesterday and over this weekend in Atlanta, it gives them even more control of humanity, where it circumvents all laws and does away with all sovereignty. You see, the power in which, the authority in which they have now is never enough. And, you know, I posted inside of Tando a story about Chernobyl and how the animals are now adjusting to the radiation. I posted that for this very reason. This tells you that they are not afraid of using nuclear weapons and nuclear technology and nuclear poisoning, radiation poisoning against people, because they know over time, like the animals, the body can probably adapt to it. What your body won't be able to adapt to and respond to is the immediate poisoning from it. So they don't care about a radiated earth. They know that they can deal with it. And they tell you everything if you just learn to listen. This is why it's so important that you need to have a plan. You need to know what is it that you're going to do. Because I'm telling you, means, motive, and opportunity says the same people that have done it in the past, from New York to Pearl Harbor to Japan to the Gulf of Tonkin to all of the other incidents of where the government had seized more authority and power against the people, because that's what this type of calamity would do. It would take away, and you would willfully, as they already said, and they instructed you this, you'll give up your freedoms because of the destruction and the death that had been waged before it. So what are they going to do? They're going to provide the stage just for that to happen. They're being set up. Totally being set up. And the key is, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? They give you this ambiguous abstract scenario of some terrorists. They give you this ambiguous abstract scenario of some hackers, knowing that they've instituted all of those institutions that work for them. It's been funded by, created by, and works for. Everything that you've been told in this country has been a lie. Everything. And until the people decide that they're not going to be used as pawns or ways and means, your way of life, the energy of your labor is not going to be used for somebody else's means of life. Your way of life will not be someone else's means of life. Then these type of scenarios will continue. Oh, they'll tell you what you need to do. They put in place some of the apparatus to somewhat help you, but there is no help for some type of event such as that. It's yo-yo. You're on your own. There's not enough anything. This is why you need to prepare for things before it happens. One of the most important things is they told you that it would not be advised for you to get your children from school. Now you see why I had told you so many times before that these people tell you, you got to have a plan. You need to have a plan to deal with pretty much anything. There is no such thing as a conspiracy theory. There are only people that commit conspiracies. That's the fact in the truth. It's conspiracy facts and conspiracy evidence is what truly exists. So I wanted you to take a look and you know, sorry we didn't have much time, but I would love to, tomorrow we'll pick up from here, and I would love to hear from you if you have some questions or comments. And I'm telling you, they already tell you everything in so many ways. The key is, will you pick up on it and be able to decipher and interpret what's being said? All of the same things that you hear and hear, I mean, that you saw in this documentary, all of this stuff was known about New York way before it happened, and guess what? It happened. All of the current events that you see right now in the Middle East and everything, people knew that this was going to happen, and it happened. They've created the perfect environment to have plausible deniability to say someone else did it when they gain from it all. Where they had the perfect motive and the opportunity, and most importantly, who gained from it? Means, motive, opportunity, and gain. Who gained from what happened in New York? All of these agencies that you see now were created. Massive funding for them, black budget, shadow government. Nothing changes. It remains the same until we decide no longer will we play the game. So, hey, everyone, I just want to thank you for listening to Tando Radio Show today. God willing, we'll be back tomorrow. The video that was played here is posted on Tando Radio Show on Facebook. If you'd like to check it out, check it out again. Check it out a couple of times. You know, it's long, but it's telling you everything. And if you prepare for things like they said, listen to where they talk about preparing. They're telling you. So just want to thank you all for listening today. We'll be back tomorrow, God willing. And it's never goodbye. It's always I'll see you later. And remember, before you ask for a blessing, to make sure to be a blessing. And we will talk tomorrow. Much love, much respect. Thank you all, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Girl, you are rich, even with nothing. Tenderness comes.